In America in the 1950s, there was a famous exhibition called The Family of Man. It put forward a new way of seeing the world as an alternative to the horrors of Nazism and communism. It showed hundreds of photographs of individuals from all around the world. The message was simple. We are all one world.
I am La Brea Man. I am First Man. Wife and I live in pits. I discover pain and boredom and how to use hands in self-defense.
I am his son. I am called Plowman. I was the first to dig the earth and make the rivers run backward. There was no stopping me or my wife.
I am his many cousins.
I chipped the stone.
I smelt the rock.
I bronzed the shoe.
I lay the asphalt.
Together, we made enough noise to keep the wolves awake.
I am his godson, civilized man. I harnessed the secret of the calendar, and with the power of the weak, I built the pyramids.
I am his mentor, Hippocrates. I put him through school, where he learned to stand up for a principle and sit down on his own stool.
I am his father, Caesarion. I sent him away from home for something to live on and paid him to fight over it.
And at the center of that world is the individual self. The man who helped design it was a refugee from Germany called Herbert Bayer. He saw it as a new kind of propaganda. Instead of being overwhelmed by dramatic stories created by those in power, the individual would make their own story out of the photographs. Bayer made a diagram to show his idea. At the center is the giant eye of the individual self, surrounded by a mass of images. It was a utopian vision of the self, selecting and arranging the fragments of images into their own story, and so becoming strong enough to withstand tyranny. Confident individuals in control of their own world.
You know, parents are the same, no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue, parents just don't understand.
Hi, this is Bing Crosby, and this is a little bit of advice on how to handle teenagers. Teenagers are positively people, so try to remember they have a lot of problems, mainly parents. When their jive talks give you the heebie-jeebies and their rootin' tootin' clothes, who's talking, make you despair for civilization, better bear up and shut up, because they'll grow up and get over with it, just as you and I.
Right on!
Scratch most little teenagers and you'll find a solid citizen.
Get your fingernails off of me, daddy-o!
You know, when they sound off with ideas for improving the world we made, well, maybe us parents could learn something if we'd stop snooting the kids.
Maybe you parents could get some good nookie, man, if you stayed close to the young kids. Right, I mean, I think that youth sex is perhaps the answer for most 45 and 50-year-old people.
And here they come now, down on the field, it's youth.
The youth sex teams
it's
are both
wonderful
out
to see
of
there, isn't it, Charlie?
They're
beautiful, Larry. Never seen 20 marching legs as trim.
Oh, there's the armored guard coming by right now. Now, that's really beautiful.
There's the four-year-olds. The four-year-olds are coming to the field, and men all over the stadium are raising, ladies and gentlemen, right now, standing up in a show of appreciation.
That's really
beautiful
wonderful.
Little girls.
The flag is coming by.
Yes, yes.
Here it comes.
Yes,
here it
yes.
comes. And there's nothing on the back of it.
There's nothing
there?
On the back
that's
of it.
That's a big surprise.
No.
Very nice.
It's all white on the back, ladies and gentlemen, so the game will go on today without code two rules. You know, that, you know
I
that
suppose
means,
that's what it means. Well, the clock is getting pretty close.
Kids are going to be able to watch this one today.
9:01. Oh, the kids are out there in force now. The Exposition Park is full of them.
There's Major Hortabagie's little black eagles.
That's right.
400 perfectly trained seven-year-olds, by the way. All of Hungarian background.
Ah, look at that. Here comes the dog corps. Isn't that wonderful? The canine patrol is
coming in. Dog upon dog upon dog upon dog.
Bob, if I may interrupt here for a minute, that's from the Dog and Dentists Council of East Los Angeles. These dogs, all of them have appeared in the films.
Well, that's just fine. I see the orchestra's on the other end of the field now.
Oh, look.
Here come the mules.
Here come the mules. La Cucaracha Mule Corps.
That's
right. And here comes their spiritual leader. leader, Darlene. Darlene, ladies and gentlemen. That mule has a wanger. Oh, boy.
Get off the table, Mabel. The quarter's for the beer.
Yeah, that was the Pledge of Allegiance.
Got another one down there.
Yes,
that was
indeed.
Phil. He's gone.
Paranoia. He comes like a diamond merchant, they say.
Paranoia. Paranoia.
Oh, no.
Should have seen this girl's bodily dimensions. I honked my horn just to get her attention. She said, was that for me? I said, yeah. She said, why? I said, come on and take a ride with the hell of a guy.
On the surface, Tupac Shakur was part of the age of the individual. He believed deeply in the idea of self-expression. But he was also one of the few in the 1980s who still believed in the power of grand stories to move people and to inspire them to change the world. His mother, Afeni, had been a Black Panther, and she still believed in the idea of revolution in America. Tupac later said, "The phrase Black Power had been like a lullaby when I was a kid. My mother, she would tell me these stories of things she did or saw, and it made me feel part of something. She always raised me to think I was the Black Prince of the Revolution." What Afeni taught him was that the world most Americans lived in, both white and black, was an unreal fairyland that concealed the harsh reality of the power that controlled their lives.
We're not being taught to deal with the world as it is. We're being taught to deal with this fairyland, which we're not even living in anymore. It's sad, because I'm telling you, and it should not be me telling you. It should be common knowledge. Aren't they wondering why death rates are going up and suicide is going up and drug abuse? Aren't they wondering? Don't they understand that more people are, more kids are being handed crack than they're being handed diplomas? I mean, it's like, you know those little things they have for the mice where they go through around a circle and there's little blocks for it and everything? Well, society is like that. They'll let you go as far as you want. But as soon as you start asking too many questions and you're ready to change, boom.
Dr. Zeus, we found that in working with these laboratory rats who were accustomed to receiving the free food, both Drs. Carter and Berkowitz offered their animals the alternative of obtaining the food pellets by pressing a lever. But this is the interesting thing in our study, that we discovered that when the rats were able to earn food by pressing the lever twice, they'd even push their free food dish out of the way in order to reach the lever. So that what we discovered is that the rats really prefer earned food to free food. Interestingly enough.
Microphone working?
Yeah.
Do I just press this?
Right over there.
Press this little lever here,
yeah.
Right?
Do you have a comment on that, Doc?
Rats gonna press levers, and I don't think that is this working?
No, there's a rat.
Well, I can understand you. But
oh, look at the little.
He's working. Little,
here, I'll get it.
It's working for you, Doc.
We pay this rat to do this. Now, if we didn't pay him, he wouldn't do it. And even if we gave him free food,
he'd die.
He would die because he wouldn't do it unless we pay him.
He's dead now.
What these rats have discovered.
I tell you that a friend of mine in Iowa.
Bill McIntyre?
No, there's someone you don't know, though, captured the young boy that lived next door and put him in a cage.
He did?
Yeah, right. Put him in a cage and offered him free food, delicacies, man, stuff from the Chinese. There's good Chinese food in Iowa.
Yeah.
Good Chinese food, Japanese food, good American home cooking, free.
Yeah.
You know, here, take it, Larry. And the kid cried a lot, moaned, and did things about, what are you doing? You're crazy and you're insane, and they'll find me. And they didn't, and he would refuse the free food.
Really?
Yeah, but when he got a chance to work.
Well, doctor, he
ate like a horse.
Dr. Berkowitz would be very happy to hear about this, since he, you know...
It's Dr. Berkowitz.
Dr. Berkowitz is the one over there in the mayonnaise jar with the holes punched in top.
Yeah.
That's right.
We put a little clover in for him every once.
Yeah, right. He's a little cannibal. He eats rats.
Yeah.
Oh, he does.
Yeah.
Well, maybe if we put the lever, Dr. Lever...
Dr. Levers, the Lever Brothers, one and two. If you push both of them, they pay you for working.
I didn't
want
to pronounce it the other way because they're
like
Jewish, you know.
That's right.
And
Levay is the way they
pronounce it. Levay, Franklin Delano Levay.
How are you getting along with the mongoose separation experiment?
Oh, well, we find that when we separate a mongoose, part of him dies, and another part of him
kicks for a while.
Patriotic nationalism, man, that's true. You know, the Mongeese would refuse to.
But it is acquired behavior. If we put other Mongeese in the proximity of the mongoose that we're separating, they get very nervous.
I think that term is freak out, Doctor.
Ah, well, that's not hardly scientific.
They won't eat any of the free food we give them to watch.
They're little rats. We give them the rats that failed the other test.
Yeah, right. They'll eat shirkers, but they won't eat workers.
No, they won't eat. That's good.
That's true.
By the 1980s, it was clear that the promises of the civil rights movement had not been kept in America. And the idealism of black politics fell away. And the communities divided into gangs that then turned on each other.
The shooting started about, 76 on Melvin. 76. You know, they stopped fighting. They just started shooting. You know, and it was something new to me. You know, we used to fight all the time. The next minute, I'm running from gunshots. So the only thing I said to myself, say, man, are we going to start doing what they're doing? You know, same thing they do to us, we do to them. Do or die, stay in the house. You know, fight or stay in the house. So I wasn't going to stay in the house for nobody.
I like the pump.
I like the spray.
The pump.
The spray.
The pump.
The spray.
Hey, Hero, you got the right to own them both. So here it is, at the Saturday Night Gun Mart. A double-barreled over and under pump spray, fully automatic, semi-automatic. It's a famous brand name. I can't mention it. I can't read it. I think it's from Czechoslovakia. Just want to wound him in the hand? We got a full assortment of handguns. Easy credit, never a hold up at the cashiers at Saturday Night Gun Mart, where you are the target.
Then crack swept through the black communities in America. And Fanny Shakur finally gave up. She became addicted to crack. And Tupac found himself alone. At the end of the 1980s, he moved to California. It was supposed to be one of the most integrated parts of the country. But one night, Tupac went to a party, and he realized that white racism was re-emerging even there.
There was a fight at the party, and I was like, what happened? He said the skinheads came and called the black people niggas and made them, they said they had to leave, and of course, there was fight. I was like, oh my God. So we were sitting there, they went home, we were sitting there talking and everything, and my friends were just like, this couldn't happen in the 60s, you know, let's figure out what to do. And I said, I know, we'll start the Black Panthers again. So we're starting the Black Panthers, but we're doing it more to fit our views, you know, less violent and more silent, you know, more knowledge.
Tupac Shakur set out to reawaken the radicalism of the Panthers. And to do it, he was going to use himself as the central character.
I hear Brenda's got a baby, but Brenda's barely got a brain. A damn shame, the girl can hardly spell her name.
That's not our problem, that's up to Brenda's family.
Well, let me show you how it affects our whole community. Now, Brenda really never knew her moms, and her dad was a junkie putting death into his arms. It's sad, cause I bet Brenda doesn't even know. Just cause you're in the ghetto doesn't mean you can't grow. She wrapped the baby up and threw him in the trash. She tried to sell crack, but ended up getting robbed. So she sees sex as a way of leaving hell. So she really can't complain, prostitute fam, swing. And Brenda's her name, she's got a baby.
But there was another country that was also like a fairy tale land. Saudi Arabia. Ever since the 1970s, billions of dollars had flooded in from the West. This vast wave of money had created a dreamlike society, run by an elite where no one paid any tax. But there were those in Saudi Arabia who saw another, much more sinister reality underneath this facade. Abu Zubaydah had been born in Saudi Arabia, but he was not a Saudi. His family were Palestinian, and he quickly discovered that if you were not a part of the Saudi elite, you were nothing. He and his family were looked down on and scorned. In the 1980s, Zubaydah grew more and more angry, and lonely. He began to write a special diary into which he poured out his feelings. It was special because it was written to be read by just one person in the future, himself in the year 2000. The diary is full of a growing fury about how Saudi Arabia had been taken over and corrupted by the vast wealth that had come into the society. He describes how everyone around him, including his friends, were false and treacherous. They pretend to be pious, but really they have no values. The money has created a society where nobody believes in anything, and nothing can be trusted. Zubaydah tried to lose himself in music. The singer he loved most was Christa Berg, and his songs like The Lady in Red. But then, at the end of the 1980s, Zubaydah discovered the ideas of jihad. At that point, modern Islamism was sweeping through the Arab world. The attraction of jihad was that by losing yourself in the struggle, you could free yourself from the emptiness and the nihilism that the Western money was bringing into societies like Saudi Arabia. Abu Zubaydah traveled to the town of Peshawar on the Afghan border to lose himself in the new revolutionary struggle that was going to remake the Arab world and him. Both Abu Zubaydah and Tupac Shakur, in their different ways, were part of something that had begun 200 years before with the French Revolution. It was the idea that through revolution, you could break through to a new kind of world. Something beyond the corrupt reality of this one. But at this same moment, a completely new way of seeing the world was rising up in America. It said that all attempts to change the world through revolution would always fail, because the world was too complicated for anyone to be able to predict the consequences of their actions. It came from engineers and scientists who were using computers to model the way the world behaved.
The difference between the MODIS simulation and the advice MODIS isn't quite as accurate.
It will not latch this data in time. The simulation would determine how long it took the signal.
They saw the world as a series of complex systems. Populations of animals, flocks of birds, whole human societies, and even global weather patterns were all complex systems that you could recreate as models inside the computers. But when the scientists did this, the computers began to reveal something they hadn't expected. One tiny change in their equations could have massive, catastrophic consequences, which they could never have predicted. It was called chaos theory.
But we're beginning to learn that very simple laws, very simple equations, can generate astonishingly complicated dynamical behavior, apparently random behavior, which we call chaos. So the bad news is we can have nothing random in the system, everything is known, and yet we cannot make long-term predictions about the future because the fluttering of a butterfly's wing will disturb the initial conditions.
Chaos theory had a very powerful influence in the West because it rose up at the very moment the Soviet Union was collapsing. And it seemed to explain why all attempts at revolution had led to disaster. The world was just too complex for human beings to change in a predictable way. But in the 1990s, as the computers became more powerful, scientists argued that even though human beings would never be able to understand the complexity, the computers could be used to see hidden underlying patterns and make the chaos manageable. This new idea was called complexity theory. One of its main promoters was the man who had discovered the elementary particles of all matter, quarks. He was called Murray Gell-Mann. and he believed that there were underlying patterns at every level of the universe. Not just in the particles, but in the way people think, in the structure of human societies, and even in the languages they spoke.
You're always looking for patterns in nature.
Yes.
Well, what's so
patterns in the way people think. Patterns in the elementary particles. It's all part of the same way of doing things, I suppose. Trying to spot the law, trying to spot relationship, customs of primitive people, languages and the relations among them. And it's fascinating to try to figure out what these laws are.
As complexity theory spread, it seemed to offer a new way of managing societies by using computers to analyze vast amounts of data. That would bypass the failed political ideas that had always led to disaster in the past. But it brought with it a deeply conservative idea that was going to be the foundation of today's computer-dominated world. It said that what you are looking for in the data are the underlying laws that govern the systems as they already exist. You never ask why those systems came to exist and who benefits from them existing. One of the leading complexity scientists insisted that the meaning of any system was irrelevant. "I don't understand what meaning is," he said. "In science, there is no meaning to anything. It doesn't ask the atom why it is going left when it is subjected to a magnetic field. It just observes and describes."
A mad man gun. A man that go kill with this is really mad. It will kill.
This you better watch out.
Is an M1 carbine, 32 rounds. I can go tap Lewis Park with this. I can kill about 32 people if I hit them all.
Guns.
All about shooting, taking them out.
Yes.
And when they come shoot us, we go back and shoot them.
As he became more successful, Tupac Shakur dramatized in his music what he called the thug life. His aim, he said, was not to try and stop the violence, but to make those in the gangs who are killing each other realize that they could turn the violence outwards instead and fight back against those who really oppressed them. But Shakur had begun to suspect that maybe many people didn't really want change, that they were happy living in their own fairy tale world of gangs and violence.
Now, if we do want to live the thug life and the gangster life and all of that, okay, so stop being cowards and let's have a revolution. But we don't want to do that. Dudes just want to live a character. They want to be cartoon. But if they really wanted to do something, they was that tough, all right, let's start our own country. Let's start a revolution. Let's get out of here. Let's do something. But they don't want to do that.
In response, Shakur was accused by a number of the gangs of simply using them, that he was sucking out details of their lives and then acting it out in his music to make himself rich, that he wasn't real. In response, Tupac tried to become more and more part of that world to prove his authenticity.
Get your cat's pill, you know, see. Grab your blocks when you see Tupac. Call the cops when you see Tupac. Who shot me, but your pumps didn't finish. Now you're about to feel the wrath of a menace. Nigga, I hit him up.
But then the black radicals accused him of getting lost in the character he had created. But really, he was reinforcing and intensifying the violence, not changing it.
Not telling me anything.
One radical wrote, "Thug ambition is completely predatory because it is driven by an individualism that deliberately avoids the fellow feeling and the group solidarity needed by revolutionaries." In 1994, Shakur was sent to jail for 5 months for raping a 17-year-old girl. Shakur found himself in the new world of mass incarceration in America. Driven by fears of a wave of violent crime, President Clinton had brought in tough new crime laws, even though in reality, crime was falling. Hundreds of thousands of young black men were now imprisoned with no hope of parole, even for minor offences. It seemed to show that President Clinton cared more about the fears of the white middle-class voters than he did about the lives of young black men. While the white radicals, who were buying Tupac Shakur's music, did nothing to challenge it. By moving radical politics into the world of culture, Tupac Shakur had also become part of the fairy tale world, because he helped keep the anger and the dissent sealed off from the real world of politics and power. And now, he was all alone.
Trust nobody. Trust nobody.
After dark.
You know what I mean? Straight up. My closest friends did me in. My closest friends, my homies, people who I done took care of their whole family. I done took care of everything for them, looked out for them, put them in the game, everything turned on me. Fear is stronger than love. Remember that. Mm-hmm. Fear is stronger than love. All the love I gave didn't mean nothing when it came to fear. So it's all good. But I'm a soldier. I always survive. I constantly come back. You know what I mean? Only thing that can kill me is death. That's the only thing that ever stopped me is death.
One night at the end of 1991, Abu Zubaydah was part of a group of jihadists attacking the city of Gardez in Afghanistan. They were trying to overthrow the communist regime left behind by the Russians 3 years before. But then suddenly, a mortar exploded next to Abu Zubaydah, and a piece of shrapnel pierced his skull. It went into his brain, and his whole way of seeing and understanding the world suddenly changed. The next day, he was taken back from the front line, over the mountains to Peshawar. For 2 months, he was unconscious. Then his memories from the past began to come back, but in a mass of fragments. Nothing linked them. They made no sense. So Zubaydah began to use his diary to write down all the flashes of memory, to try and make sense of who he was. In the end, it would run to over 1,000 pages, a vast collage of memories and feelings, moments of intense loneliness as a child, of watching Pluto meet an angel in a Disney cartoon, moments of fear in combat, the smell of perfume, the anger he felt at friends, moments of sexual desire, and the sensation of autumn coming on. When he had physically recovered, Abu Zubaydah went back to the jihad training camps in Afghanistan. But he found that whatever he did, he could not put his memories back together. They remained just fragments in his brain. He also had a growing sense that the whole organization of jihad was disintegrating into rival factions. All ideas of solidarity and collective action had gone. In the diary, he describes how you couldn't trust anyone any longer. Zubaydah knew bin Laden, who was running another jihad camp. Bin Laden asked him to make an alliance, but Zubaydah refused. He was aware that bin Laden was planning some kind of retaliation against the Americans, but he didn't trust him. Zubaydah spent his time making explosives and watching American movies like Rambo 3. Zubaydah wrote in his diary how up in the mountains, everything was falling apart. The revolutionary dream of Islamism was failing. Or his sense of who he was, his identity, had disintegrated into random memories. They meant nothing. There was no story that made sense. He wrote how it was as though time had stopped. He was trapped in a perpetual now, haunted by fragments of memory, with no way of moving forward into the future. But in the West, scientists were beginning to ask whether the very idea of an integrated self was actually a fiction for everyone. In the 1980s, the new group of behavioral psychologists had argued that what human beings think of as their self was not fully in control of their actions. Now, they had been joined by neuroscientists who said they had discovered something even stranger. That inside their brains, human beings had all kinds of different selves, which the conscious mind had no awareness of at all.
So that was her horrible secret. Poor Nancy, married to a man 1,000 years old. Now I understood why the servants had disappeared. It was Catherwood who killed Rococo to protect his wife, my Betty Jo.
Who is he talking to? How does he make his voice do that?
All right, Bradshaw, there's your confession. I hope you got it all down. Bradshaw? Bradshaw. Oh, that's right. He's not in this flashback. I'll skip ahead a bit. No, I can't skip ahead. All right, everybody. Into the time machine.
No. You don't understand how radio works. Now, this is my flashback. All I have to do to return us to the present is fade my voice out like this and cue the organist. You see, here we are.
Oh my goodness.
What's happening? Am I seeing double? There's two of everybody except me.
Pandemonium was breaking out all around me.
Wait a minute.
Who are you?
I was here first.
You imposter. Take that.
That's terrible.
You keep away from him, you young hussy.
Who are you calling a hussy, you old bag?
Well, how dare you talk to me like that?
I can talk to me any way I like.
What nerve? I'm not you. You're me 20 years ago.
What? You have a lot of nerve saying I'm going to look like that in 20 years?
Oh, yeah?
There ain't room enough in this dress for both of us. Get your knife.
Well, this is a bit of fun, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is, Dad. Glad to have someone my own age to talk to after all these years.
Why don't we sing something?
Well, I've forgotten the key.
Oh, that's all right. I've got a lid out in the car.
David?
Half-caste woman, living a life apart. Where did your story begin?
Stop it. Stop singing, you fools. Can't you see someone has been crushed here under this car? Oh, my God, it's me. I don't look at all well. I'm dead. I've been killed. Oh, this hasn't happened to me since M.
I did a quick 20-20 on the whole scene.
I thought that I was the only one going insane. But now we are all in this together.
I knew what I had to do.
I didn't like it, but that never stopped me before. All right, everybody, take off your...
They were led by Michael Gazzaniga, who would win a Nobel Prize for his work.
With your right hand, you point to this row, and with your left hand, you point to this row.
Okay.
Gazzaniga studied the brains of people like Vicky. She suffered from extreme epilepsy. To try and stop her attacks, surgeons had cut the nerve fibres that linked the two sides of her brain. It worked, but it also revealed something very strange. There was another force inside Vicky that emerged, that kept trying to take control.
I knew what I wanted to wear, and I would open up my closet, get ready to take it out. My other hand would, like, just take control. And it would just reach in and get something that I wouldn't want at all. And a couple times I had a pair of shorts on, and then I find myself putting another pair of shorts on top of a pair I already had on, and which I knew was wrong.
Gazzaniga argued that really there were multiple selves inside the human brain, each one taking control at different moments. Normally that is hidden, because the one self that is conscious constantly makes up stories to explain what all the other selves are doing. But when the connection between the two parts of the brain is cut, it can't do that. And the other parts emerge. Vicky wasn't strange, Gazzaniga said. She just showed the truth. Gazzaniga argued that really, all human beings live in a made-up dream world of stories, which give them the illusion that they are in control. When really, there is something else inside them that they will never contact.
We have to quit viewing man as a single psychological entity, that in fact, his psychological self is a multiple self, that he has a variety of mental systems, existing in his brain. They have emotions, they have memories, they have incentives, they have destinies, and they're able to control the motor apparatus, by which I mean they're able to make movements, they're able to actually precipitate behaviors on the part of someone. And once those actions are completed, here comes this verbal system in to give an explanation and to propose a theory to itself to explain why these actions were carried out.
The 1990s was the high point of the idea of individualism. With all the old revolutions gone, it promised the vision of a new world of free, confident people. But what was happening was that the sciences that had grown up with that individualism were now turning on it and eating away at it. Complexity theory said that human beings were just components in vast, complex systems. Systems that they would never be able to understand. Which meant that what they thought and what they felt was irrelevant to the system. While psychology, and now neuroscience, said that much of what went on inside people's brains was beyond their control. Which meant that the conscious bit inside the brain, the part that applies meaning to the world, was actually irrelevant. Bit by bit, the idea of the world as something that human beings could understand and change was disappearing. Human consciousness was being sidelined. In 1996, Tupac Shakur was shot in Las Vegas. He was taken to hospital in a critical condition. 6 days later, he died. Still today, no one knows who shot him.
Hey, how about Harry Reid? I thought Harry Reid was a really smart guy, and he has been a very powerful majority leader. But the fact that he came out, what, day before yesterday saying, end prostitution in Nevada. Now, I agree. I think, you know, I'm not fond of prostitution. I don't think it should be criminalized, but he wants to criminalize it because he said it's bad for the image of the state, and it keeps respectable business out of Nevada. Business to do what? the places like Afghanistan.
Yeah.
All there is deserts and slot machines and whorehouses. That's all they got. And military bases.
Oh, lots and lots of military bases.
And lots of whores and lots of slot machines.
There's got to be there has to be a state where it's all legal.
Well, that's...
You know, and that's Nevada. I mean, what
people
what
are not,
has he got without it?
But people aren't going to take a plane from, like, Tampa to get laid legally in Nevada. Or maybe they do. Maybe they do. Maybe lots of people do.
Yeah, well, but you can go and you know, I mean, now you can gamble any place.
That's
so
true. But you can't get laid legally every place.
Not every place.
No, you can't.
No, not every
where
place.
Where? Except Nevada.
What a ghastly idea.
Is there
drive out in the desert as some...
To the Bunny Mustang Ranch.
You're that desperate, you know.
Oh, it's so sad.
Yeah, yeah. Really so he, sad. But that's Harry's big move for his state, huh?
Well, when I was walking, I did a gig in, it was many years ago, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I did a gig in Las Vegas, and I'm walking down the strip, and this guy's saying, $100 And I said, I turned to him, and I looked at him, nobody makes eye contact with these guys, you know. I said, what's the other girl for? Does she take notes? And the guy looks at me for a second, blinks, and says, two girls, $100. $100. I mean, that's just so degrading.
Take notes. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I don't
know. It's maybe the other girl is studying for her, you know, sociology.
They're all studying, you know, to go to college. I'm not a whore. I'm not on the pole. I'm just earning enough money to go to business school so I can open another Bunny Mustang Ranch somewhere and know what I'm doing.
Yeah, get that MBA. Yeah. Get that MBA.
I don't know. It's really hard to tell what the hell is going on, Dave.